Live from Abu Dhabi, this is The Breakfast Show with Kate Jones on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to a very exciting episode of Teachers Talk Radio. I am live from Abu Dhabi and joining me all the way from Melbourne, Australia is Professor John Hattie. So if you're listening live, do get involved. Hashtag TT Radio, hashtag Ask Hattie, hashtag Chatty.
Live from Abu Dhabi, this is The Breakfast Show with Kate Jones on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/TT Radio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TT Radio.
Right, good afternoon, John. And it's The Breakfast Show, but it's afternoon for you.
Afternoon, Kate. Great to talk to you. Look forward to all these questions.
As I said, hashtag Ask Catty. And then somebody else, I can't take credit for the hashtag Chatty one, but I did really like that. So what we usually do, just to start off with, although you are incredibly well known in education, is just a little quick bio. And as I've been reading up about you, I thought it was really interesting because although your PhD is in measurement and statistics, I just assumed that you used to be a maths teacher, but you used to be a music teacher. Is that correct?
That's correct. When I went to my first job as a teacher, they put me in charge of phys ed because I was a male, and they gave the phys ed teacher, they gave her music. But music has been what I did when I was teaching, and then I taught in the secondary school, and it was music. And yeah, music has been my hobby and passion for many years.
Oh, that's really interesting. And you still consider yourself a teacher because you work with PhD students now?
I do. I've just actually retired from my university job, and 207 PhD and about 30 students later, it's the best part of the job. They keep you young, they keep you excited, they pay to come to university, they go deeply into subjects, they teach you stuff, and I get paid for that. Isn't that incredible?
Oh, that is amazing. And actually, one of my questions later on was, what's next for John Hattie? But you've just answered that. You said you've been retiring from your university work. What about meta-analysis? Are you still going with that? Or are you retiring from that? Yeah. Are you still going with that?
Well, you can't stop the researchers. So, yes, my plan is that we've set up a family foundation to give back. And part of that will be keeping going on the research work and on the meta-analysis. I also have a clinical job here in Australia that I have had for the last 7 or 8 years where the federal government, I'm the chair of the board of one of the federal government agencies, so that's very exciting in education. So I've got plenty to do, and very, very soon after that, as soon as this call is over, two of my four granddaughters are coming, and so that also is keeping me young, busy, and just fun.
Oh, lovely. Oh, I hope you don't go to their parents' evening. Imagine that, John Hattie. That would be actually daunting, but lovely as well. But in terms of your work that we're going to talk about with visible learning, lots of our listeners are trainee teachers, newly qualified teachers, or perhaps some of them are familiar with your work. But I just thought a really good starting point would be to explain these terms, research, meta-analysis, meta-synthesis. There is on YouTube a Hattie's Guide for Dummies, and that's about 8,000 views. I know, we're not trying to dumb anything down, but I just thought this would be a really good starting point. And please do correct me if I'm wrong, John, or elaborate. But basically then, so research is the collection of information and data, we know that. Meta-analysis isn't research itself, but instead it's research grouped together, and then meta-synthesis takes the meta-analysis and then you synthesize it to try and form a bigger picture and then share that with us all. Is that correct sort of summary?
Yeah, you've got it done, yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
On the shoulder of giants, and that I do a meta-analysis of meta-analyses. And that's quite frankly, the easy part of the work. The hard part of the work is trying to interpret and understand what it all means.
Where do you even begin with something like that? I mean, because I'm really interested in retrieval practice and I've written a lot about that and the research just in that particular field, there's so much and it's overwhelming. So I suppose, do you have a team? Do you just, I don't know, where would you even begin with a meta-analysis? I wouldn't even have a clue.
Well, going to the, you know, the heart of what you do, Kate, in your great book on retrieval analysis, what we did about 4 or 5 years ago is we said, could we do what we did to achievement as the outcome? And this time we looked at learning strategies, of which retrieval practice is one of them. And so we actually did a meta-synthesis of not up to 1,700 meta-analyses. There was only about 600 different meta-analyses looking at learning strategies to try and make sense of that. And we had this very naive notion that we'd come up with the top 10 learning strategies. But it didn't work out that simple because the learning strategies changed depending on some factors in terms of their effectiveness. But this is the beauty of meta-analysis. It does allow you to get on top of an incredible amount of research that others have done.
Yeah, and teachers, you know, we in the classroom, we don't have the time, obviously, to wade through all of this research. So your work is incredibly helpful. And in terms of, we've explained that, so hopefully all our listeners are understand about the meta-analysis. Do you still use the term effect size? Because I've heard you talk about, you know, progress and growth and over a period of time. So for anyone who's perhaps not sure what effect size is, could you perhaps sort of, and I apologize, do not mean this patronizing. That was a question that was sent by quite a few people just saying, what is an effect size?
It's a jargon word. It came out of the statistics area. If I explained it as it's a measure of standard deviation difference between two groups or over time, that often doesn't help either. And that's why I tried to come up with other ways of expressing it. Quite frankly, it's kind of like an earthquake. It's the Richter scale is a measure of how big the earthquake is. Well, effect size is a measure of how big the effect is. Now, that's the easy explanation. It's got a lot of nuances and detail and all that, but fundamentally, it's how big is the difference? So when you introduce something into your school, one of the things that actually surprised me when I was doing the work is virtually everything works. Virtually everything. You can quite correctly argue that there is evidence to support anything. And so that's not very interesting. What's interesting is how big is that effect? And that's what effect size has tried to capture.
Yeah, I love that because actually I just think you're very positive and optimistic because you're saying it works, what we're doing. We just need to look at what works best, isn't it? And then that's the key question. And then that links in with everything that you've done with Know Thy Impact. Love that, by the way. Isn't that what you wanted your book to be called, Visible Learning? You wanted it to be called Know Thy Impact. But I was listening to...
Well, there's a reason for that, Kate. It's my fault. In the early days, there was so much attention to the league table of influences, you know, the top 150 things. And what schools were doing is they were taking the stuff at the top and saying, we're doing that, and not doing the stuff at the bottom, which was not my message. It wasn't at all. So I switched the focus to this Know Thy Impact. It's about using the research evidence as probability statements. If you do these high-impact things, you've got a higher probability of having an impact. But what matters is how you introduce it in your school. Like, take reciprocal teaching or take retrieval practice. A better example, because it's close to your heart. We know it has a very high effect size, I think 0.74 in my work, which is very high. But if you implement it badly at the wrong time, it's not going to work. So schools that say, oh, they do retrieval practice, that doesn't tell me much at all, other than that it's smart to pick a high-impact intervention. Knowing thy impact, knowing your impact. And it was funny, when I did a Google search on the term, no one had ever used it before. I thought, oh, that's the art. Choose something no one's used so you can put a more sense around what that means. And so that's where that came from.
Oh, well, if you Google it now, John, there's loads of inspirational quotes, photos, Know Thy Impact. It's a great mantra in schools. And something else linked to this that you talk about is obviously the importance of teachers and collaborating together about, because that's, you know, the core of Thy Impact. There was a question that I wanted to ask you because I'm from the UK originally, but I'm here in the United Arab Emirates. And in these countries and other countries, there are still teachers being graded. So sometimes trainee teachers are graded at the end of a placement as outstanding or very good. And then there's also sometimes individual lesson observations that are happening, where at the end of that lesson observation, a teacher has a single grade. And I just wanted to ask, what do you think about grading teachers?
The key is what we're actually doing in that grading process. Like, as you said, my background is a measurement statistician, so I'm not opposed to grading. What I am opposed to is grading that has perverse or adverse effects. And so the first thing I'd note is that we shouldn't grade the teacher. We shouldn't even grade the teaching. We should be grading the impact of that teaching on kids. And one of my frustrations with a lot of that teacher observation is that we're watching the wrong people. We're watching the teacher. And a lot of, particularly teacher education, is focused on how we can get that teacher teaching in ways like me. Well, I don't care. What if it's not having an impact on the kids? And when you rephrase the question and say, how can independent observers, which is what these judges and people are, how can they help you better understand the impact you're having on the students in your class? Then they become supporters in the activity as well as, sometimes instead of judges. But my frustration is a lot of that grading is on how they teach. Do they teach like me? Or do they miss an opportunity which they could have done something that I would have done? And that's really of very little value. But one of the jobs that in my political role we're given at the moment is the minister wanted to improve the grading or evaluation of teachers. And we convinced them to say, no, let's turn it on its head. How can we improve the evaluation of teachers so that they value that evaluation? And suddenly you have to go into a different role and come up with ways to support teachers. But at the end of it, you still might want to make a grading, and I want to make a grading in terms of, was this class an inviting place for kids to come to? Were the kids making progress? Were they doing more than doing? Were there any learning? And in that, I want to use the teacher observation, the observer observation, the test scores, the artifacts the kids work, and the student voice about their learning. I don't think that one teacher with 20 or 30 kids sees everything, knows everything. That Graham Nuttall showed that 80% of what happens in every classroom, the teacher doesn't see or hear. What an incredible value to have other people in the classroom, if that's what it is. So if the grading is helping, is based on the impact you're having, I don't have any problems with that.
That's a great answer. We've got a listener who's just contacted us, Nadia from Norfolk, and she said, oh my God, yes, Hattie rocks. So thank you, Nadia. No, that's a really good. I really like that answer because I've just found it a little bit problematic. And I think there's even been times with these biases that people have where they can think before they even entered a lesson. Well, somebody did say that to me, actually. He said, oh, well, you do a lot of, you know, writing books and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, you'll no doubt be outstanding. And there we sort of get into quite problematic territory. But I really like that about shifting the focus about who we're looking at and actually looking at the impact. Now, when you said about, you know, lots of things work, but we need to look at what works best. Obviously, something that you've done a lot of work on is feedback. And I've got your book right in front of me with Shirley Clark. It's brilliant. And I love this quote. It's from Michael Charles' Feedback Pendulum, but it's you. And you say, if feedback falls in the classroom and no one hears it, did it make a sound? Wow. Sorry, I thought that was really good. So my sort of scenario I'll give you with feedback was that in a previous school, there was a whole school marking feedback policy and we all had to stick to it. And this was a few years ago now, but it was the colour pen, how often you did it. And it tended to be you write a comment, the students write a comment in response, then you respond to them. And I was very frustrated by that. But as a classroom teacher, I just felt I've just got to go with it and just do what everyone else is doing. And I'm really sort of embarrassed to say that it gave me this attitude, what's the point in reading about feedback? Because I have to just follow the party line. But then as I progressed in my career, I did do more reading and I became more confident to share things that you were writing about and Dylan William and lots of them, Shirley Clark, So in terms of feedback, I thought I'd phrase a question in this context, because it's the school leaders who often make decisions at a whole school departmental level. What advice would you give to school leaders in terms of what they should know or be aware of when it comes to feedback?
Well, the fascinating thing with feedback, Kate, is that yes, it's amongst the most powerful influences, but it's also one of the most variable. Like a third of feedback that we give is negative, and not appreciating that really matters. And I remember meeting a Minister of Education in your ex-country, who, when he met me, and you'll be so pleased, he said, I have declared that here in England next year is going to be the year of feedback. Now, I lost a lot of brownie points at that point, so I said, oh, Minister, does that mean the year after they don't? And that's the problem with feedback. It becomes a bandwagon. And then also your Ofsted had this crazy idea that every piece of work was going to be inspected to see if it's got at least five lines or whatever of written comments. Well, they made that do that for five-year-olds who couldn't read it. That's bonkers. But the big thing about feedback and the message I'd love to get across today is want it heard, understood, and actionable. See feedback through the kids' eyes. Like, you go into any classroom, oh my gosh, and I wish a lot of researchers would do this, and look at the amount of feedback teachers give. It's a huge amount. That's not the issue. It's was it heard, understood, and actionable. And this is where you're saying in your work that we should actually be stopping every now and then and saying to the students, wait a day, so it's not just memory. I gave you some feedback yesterday on your work. Write some notes, write some bullet points. What did you understand? What did you want to hear? What did you want to do next from it? And it's very, very sobering. Despite the page, two pages of comments a teacher might have written, kids will say, I got the feedback. And that's primarily because from a student point of view, what they want in feedback is where they go next. Now, they also want to know how to go next. And for all the stuff we write, the praise, which we know has a dilution effect, this is wrong, but that's not feedback from the kid's point of view. And so I think we've got to be a lot smarter about feedback. So I plead to you those three questions. Was it heard? And often it's not heard. Was it understood? They might have heard it, misunderstood it. And when we get kids to write comments and interview them about the feedback they get, oh my gosh, sometimes they get the priorities wrong, they misunderstand the feedback. So understanding is important. And is it actionable? And here's the bottom line. If it isn't actioned, it's not worthwhile feedback.
Yeah, well, that links back to that quote about from Michael Charles's book that you said about if it falls in the classroom, no one hears it, did it make a sound? And again, know thy impact. So that's really interesting as well. And that I've been listening and I've immersed myself in your work this week. And so I remember you saying something in an interview about when your work was, should we say, ranked at one point into what works best. I remember you being quite concerned about it becoming a sort of tick box activity or the same thing as well. Like, just because feedback is taking place doesn't mean that it is actually effective. So we do really need to think very carefully about these things. And that actually links into something that I wanted to ask as well, because I mean, your work is incredible. You described your book is described as the holy grail of teaching and learning by a TES reporter.
Hey, be careful. Monty Python doesn't even find the holy grail. I'm not sure either.
Well, you have sold over a million copies, and that's way more than me. So you have been incredibly successful. What I do really like about you, John, is that you are very open to constructive criticism. You've acknowledged it in your books. You went on Ollie Lovell's podcast to respond to criticism. And you've even said that the best critique has probably been from your wife and how she helped make your book even better. And linked to all of that, I just wanted to ask, what do you think is perhaps the biggest or main misconception or misunderstanding that people have about your work or visible learning?
Well, let me answer that two halves. The first half is the critics out there that get on the internet or publish articles. About a year ago, we collected every single criticism that we could find, and there was about 110 or so of them. And we wrote this paper, which we put online, about the criticisms. And interestingly, about 70 to 80% of them were all based on that big table. And quite frankly, virtually every one of those criticisms never opened the book. like the biggest crevices of rock. Yeah. Oh, if the influence is not independent, they overlap. Well, I say at the very beginning, it took me 20 years to understand that overlap, and that's what the book's about, but they ignore that. But the other part of it is, and it's my fault, is that notion that we tick top, don't do the bottom. That's a problem. And what I find unbelievably remarkable, it's been, what, 12 years since the book was produced. No one has come up with a different explanation. That is just unusual in academia. Everyone's rushing around to come up with a better explanation. So last year, I actually set up a website called BetterX, which is free, and it's got all the data in it. I'll be saying, some academic teacher, here it is. You don't have to spend 30 years collecting your data. I've done it. I'm going to put it out there. In fact, we're about to update it with more data in it. And so I really think the biggest criticism is yet to come. And the first person who comes up with a better explanation than me, I'm going to stand up and say thank you.
Yeah, well, you are very open. When I've spoken to people, they haven't read your book, some of the people that I've spoken to, and Invisible Learning, you have a section, Problems with Meta-Analysis. So you already addressed some of this critique. But actually, that reminds me of Carol Dweck. I know, obviously, you're very familiar with Carol Dweck, with growth mindset, and how that, should we say, got misunderstood in schools. And again, lots of schools, including, this is myself as well, I worked in a school, we embraced growth mindset, and we didn't read the book. And that's probably where it went wrong, isn't it, really?
Wow. I had a lovely one night with Carol and her husband, David, and most of the conversation was about the frustration both of us have about people misunderstanding our work. And like I said to Carol at one point, I'm not even sure there's such a thing as a growth mindset. And she put a knife and fork down. Her Steely Gaines came to me and she said, John, a growth mindset is the most fixed mindset of a lot. Because I've spent my whole life saying there are circumstances when growth matters and when there are not matters. And I went a step further, and as you did a fancy restaurant, so I pulled out a folder of every article she had written. I said, Carol, there's only one time that a growth mindset matters. Listen to what you said. In times of lack of confidence, confusion, not knowing what to do, then growth matters. She said, that's what I've been saying for 30 years, but people run around and they run these programs on growth mindset, not yet. She said, I was the first to do it, and I killed her because the kids could do all that stuff. Then they went back to the classroom, got a difficult math problem, a difficult music situation, and they said, oh, I can't do this. She said, failed. There was no transfer. And so she's actually about to produce a new book coming out very soon with a new program that is much more effective than what most people do. So it's one of those bandwagons that gets misunderstood, and then the irony is, criticised for what she didn't say.
Yeah, that is a problem in education with these lethal mutations and this misunderstanding, and it is definitely something for us to be aware of. But that links in really nicely to a question from a listener, and he's also part of the Teacher Talk radio team. So Tom Hopkins Burke asked, and by the way, I wrote down four answers for this. I thought I'd try and guess who your potential people could be. So the question is, who in education has been the biggest influence on you and why? And then afterwards, I'll see if my my guesses are correct or not. So who's been the biggest influence on you in education and for what reason?
Well, that's tough because you're asking for an individual.
Yeah, I wrote four down. You can name as many as you want, but I imagine that is tough because I've read your acknowledgements and you're always very thankful towards a lot of people.
Look, I've had a very naive life in the sense of being born in a small country town with very limited horizons back in the 1950s. No television, that. I look back and say, you know, I can think of two or three teachers that had a big impact on me, but probably not that led me to do what I'm doing today, because I fell into this kind of world. I can think of my PhD supervisor, Rod McDonald. He was, but the thing that's most interesting, and sorry to do this to you, Kate, a couple of years ago, we actually did a research study and asked adults about the most impactful teacher they ever had and why. And it resonated with me. There were two answers. And the first answer was those teachers who turned you onto their passion. And certainly my PhD supervisor did that. And the second thing, and it's an and or, those teachers who turned you onto their passion, or those teachers who saw something in you that you didn't see in yourself. And that's why keep going on about the role of education is not to help kids reach their potential. What a damning indictment that can be. It's to help kids exceed what they think their potential is. And so I've had people that have done that to me over the years, and I particularly pick out Rod McDonald. I don't know why he picked up this little colonial boy when I went to Canada to do my PhD, and persevered with me when better people wouldn't have given up. So that's fair. And of course, I've got grandchildren now, but obviously having children, oh my gosh, today sober you up in terms of making sure that you ask the right questions. So coming back, Mr. Tomlinson, my high school maths teacher, who turned me on to maths, and probably Rod McDonald, who saw something in me I didn't see, and I'm eternally grateful to them. And what I learned from them is that's my job now. Like when I work with my thesis students, my job is to make them better than I think they can be. And I hope that's what I've been doing over the years.
Oh, well, I mean, that is a very difficult question to answer. I'm not sure who I would say, because there's people who've had an impact on me in terms of authors that I've never met, right, like yourself. And then there's also colleagues and my old teachers. These are my four people that I did write down. Just the sense of from what I've read, I put obviously Shirley Clarke, because you've worked with her with the book. And Carol Dweck, because I know obviously you're a friend, and again you admire her work. I wrote Graham Nuttall because he's someone I loved his book Hidden Lives of Learners, and I've noticed the references you've made and the work he did.
He's a good New Zealander. I was brought up 100 miles south. We didn't always get on well together in many different ways, but he was a superb researcher. He was a very, very good critic, and I just wish he had published more. That one book was the only book, and unfortunately it was published after he passed away, but it is one of still the most impressive work out there.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And then Professor Janet Clinton as well. Yeah, over there.
Well, she's pretty special,
eh? Yeah, she is. And were you speaking on the, is it the World Education Summit? Were you speaking alongside each other quite recently? I saw you.
Yes, we are. Like, she's a professor of evaluation. She's an academic in her own right. She used to go by the name of Hattie, but she changed it back because she got sick of people thinking she was my appendage. And she's not.
I was aware of Professor Janet Clinton and didn't make that connection actually, but obviously you do thank Janet in your books, and she's helped you with the Visible Learning books, hasn't she? So you're like a research power couple, like the Bjorks. I thought that was lovely. So that's anyway lots of great influences in your life. Another question that was sent to us from a listener. And this is something I think you spoke about recently, and obviously it's very, very topical. It's about learning loss, and lots of things, phrases are being bandied around, like closing the COVID gap and lost learning. And what's your response to teachers sort of asking about moving forwards after COVID and the impact that COVID has had? It's been a tough year.
Look, I do get frustrated with the automatic reaction that last year was a loss. It absolutely insults the incredible expertise that I saw happening with teachers to make truly make a difference under incredible circumstances. And the first thing, Kate, is I don't know a single policy that came down from any government or any department that helped teachers and school leaders to teach in the way that they had to during COVID, other than whether the school should open or not. It truly was the greatest educational revolution we've seen from educators. And I'm sad already that we're slipping back, and yet again, the policies are coming from down on top and we're not listening. I saw more collective advocacy by principals last year than I've ever seen in school systems. And when you start to look at the evidence, the Netherlands has come out with evidence, New Zealand's come out with it, some of the US studies. If you compare what happened last year, on average, to the previous 10 years, it was not much different. And in some circumstances, it was better. In the high school exam systems, it's better under the COVID. And that was certainly true when Christchurch had its earthquake as well. Now, don't get me wrong, COVID amplified existing differences. And so, yes, there was a lot of problems with some kids in terms of access, the equity issues, social and emotional learning, but surely now should never be relegated to the sidelines after last year. It's back right into the fore. And I acknowledge all that. And there was unemployment, there was death, you name it. But I do think we are missing an opportunity. And I'm pleased, for instance, in England, where Kevin Collis has been given the job as the COVID czar, to look at the things that really did well so that we can bring back wiser. And I'm trying to convince governments here in Australia that we shouldn't not look at those things. I think the biggest travesty of COVID is pretending it never happened in terms of what we can do in schooling. And like as teachers who talk a lot, who are absolutely in control of their class, weren't able to do that on distance learning. They had to turn into kind of triage people where they worked out priorities, where they got kids to be taught the skills of working in groups, teaching themselves to be their own teachers, knowing where to seek help. I saw in the work we're doing at the moment, I saw much more often that kids were willing, through Zoom, through the chat rooms, to talk about what they didn't know and the errors and mistakes than you see in a classroom. We have got so much to learn to bring back to the regular classroom. So I implore you all of us to have the discussion yourself. Write down 10 things that worked well. Yeah, you can write down 10 things that didn't work well too. But have a debate about those things that really worked well and say, how can we do that? No, I'm not advocating that we should go back and teach kids from home. We can do a lot of that Zoom work in our class and our school. We've got so much opportunity to teach the skills of self-regulation, to have that gradual release of responsibility by teachers. I think we learned tremendous amounts. So my plea is, let's be positive as well as negative. And every time someone says learning lost, well, who lost? Some people gained. Let's be smart about this.
Yeah, lots of positive feedback. Again, I mentioned this before about your optimism when it comes to education, and that for me, as well as everything you've shared with the research, but it is that optimism that I do find really inspiring. And actually, it's changing that narrative, isn't it? It's everything we've spoke about, from the feedback, from the graded lesson observations to COVID. It is changing that narrative and that focus. And also, very recently, there was an article in the TES quoting you. I think this is again from the World Education Summit, where you were basically saying that teachers, we should focus on transfer. So that should really be a priority. This is something you've written about a lot, isn't it? About the transfer from surface, so that's about learning the content, to deep, to knowing the how, the connections, relationships, ideas. Do you have any insight? Apologise, I'm putting you on the spot. This is a live radio show. I said John was great. I said questions will just come as we air. But do you have any advice for teachers in terms of how can we get better with transfer, so to speak?
Yeah, I think most of this work, where she's got this app she uses to get transcripts of teachers' classes, and then they can get an immediate response and coding and all those kind of things. But having analysed that 17,000 hours of classroom behaviour, 90% of what teachers do in classrooms, what they talk about, their questions, is about the content. And there's a conspiracy. Kids above the average want teachers to talk more and talk more about the content. But that's the game they're good at. That's what they're winners at, and they want more of it. And that's not really serving them or the other kids very well. So how do you get that balance of the surface and the deep, and then the transfer? And then you've got another problem, Kate, where so many schools go straight to the deep, and they have inquiry and problem-based. And we know the effect size of those are very, very low, primarily because the kids need the knowledge before they go to relating the ideas about the knowledge. So they rush in too quickly. And so in our learning model, we call it the Kenny Rogers model. You've got to know when to hold them, you've got to know when to play them, and that's the skill. And like, it's the skill of retrieval practice. There's a right time for retrieval practice, and there's a wrong time. And same here. And so any effort to move the kids from the surface to the deep and the transfer, and I'm greedy. I want the lot. To me, it's not either or, it's the lot. And I think there's a lot of interesting work that's coming out looking at the transfer. It's my simple, quick statement for every teacher listening here today. Every lesson that you give, just name one strategy that you're going to teach as well, like note-taking or retrieval practice or similarities and differences and deconstructing the getting kids to work out what actually is the problem that they're solving. Just one for every lesson. And I think we'll make a massive step forward. Because from the kids' point of view, they learn very quickly by age 8 that knowing lots is what matters in schools. When you ask teachers, they say, no, it's much more than that. And they're right. But from a kid point of view, it is about knowing lots. And that's just sad that that's the status of where we're at. Not knowing, failure should be the learner's best friend. And so looking at least one strategy for every class would be a massive step forward.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And actually, I've already mentioned, I'm sure you're aware of Professors Robert and Elizabeth Bjork, and I'm huge fans of them. And when I was in touch with them, Elizabeth Bjork mentioned her frustration of doing research for decades and it not getting to the people who need to know it, the teachers. And then I said to her, you're absolutely right. And I'd elaborate on that we need to share that with in a student-friendly way, but with our learners as well. For example, about this is retrieval practice, this is why it works, this is why you should be doing it. And what you've done as well, John, a real leader in this field, is actually closing the gap between the academic community and the teaching community. Like you, for example, I'm a classroom teacher here, talking to you now, putting questions to you, because as I've said, there's lots of barriers for teachers to get to grips with research. But I mean, you've been doing this research, I know, for again, decades. So do you feel that you can see the improvements that research is now becoming a lot more accessible to teachers, and that the gap between academia and the teaching profession is closing?
I think 10 years ago, if we'd had this conversation, research would have still been this arcane thing you did in your spare time or if you were deeply fascinated. But you've got to note, in the last 10 years, there are so many teachers and school leaders now that do look at research as part of their day job. They don't have to agree with it. They don't just have to write. But now it's becoming normal. And the EFF, the Dylan Williams, the Guy Claxtons, have really made research come alive in a way for teachers. And whilst we've got a long way to go, I would say right at the moment, but the days of evidence are probably over. We've got so much evidence, it's scary. The days of interpreting it, using it, and mobilising it are here. And I think that, I've learned this, that every time I write something, the audience you're writing for, I've got a very eclectic audience. My first books, I wrote 9 books before Visible Learning. No one's ever heard of them. I wrote them for about 10 colleagues. And so I've learned to, and that's where Janet was really good to me when I wrote, actually, it was the 4th version of Visible Learning, and I was very, very proud of it. Oh, my gosh, it was full of statistics and graphs and numbers and conditionals. And she read it, and her criticism was, for which 2 people in the world did you write this for? And so I threw it away and started again and started saying, no, I want to get this message out to the teachers as well. Now, I get criticized from that from my research community that I'm writing popularist stuff. But, yes, I hope it is popular with the audience I care about. But I think the biggest change in the last 10 years is that the kind of research that educators and researchers do is now a part and parcel. Oh my gosh, we've got a long way to go. And I wish more academics realised who made them. The public, the kids, the parents, the teachers, and started to speak to them. And I know there's an art in it, but I think getting away from H indices and impacts and getting to more visibility of what we do, that's very exciting. And I just think it's an exciting world we live in now where even your callers are questioning, querying what I'm doing. That wouldn't happen 20 years ago. They'd say, academic, not going to listen to that. What a world change.
Yeah, absolutely. When I started my career, I wasn't engaging with research. I didn't really feel like they sort of, it's really bizarre. Well, I suppose teachers, we have a lot to do, and I felt, oh, I don't have time for this. And now it's just become a huge part of my life, but also incredibly enjoyable. It helps with my confidence as a teacher as well, and what I'm doing in the classroom. And this links into a question from one of our listeners, Tom Pattinson from the UK, and he's just asked, what was the last great educational book you've read, and why would you recommend it? I know you do read a lot. Well, we had Guy Claxton on yesterday, and you've recommended his book recently.
Well, yeah, his new one's quite different for Guy. That he's doing something that's dear to my heart, and he's saying, let's stop this crazy bipolar debate about whether it's inquiry or whether it's content. It's about doing both. And I'm rushing now because I'm embarrassed that I've read this book very recently, but I can't remember. Julie Stern has written a book on transfer. Oh, my God, it's impressive.
Okay.
And then the other one I'm trying to think of is the one on Walsh, on student questioning. She wrote a book on teacher questioning, and I met her a few years ago, and I said, look, it's a great book, but I want a book on student questioning. How do you teach kids the question? And she's just come out with it. Really quite impressive. And I'm easily impressed with those kind of books. When I see books that people speak to you and realise that they've written it for us as an audience, they're quite impressive. But they certainly stand that up as two other ones recently.
Oh, well, actually, I just wanted to talk about a book of yours. I've got a lot of your books, but probably maybe not as well known. I think Visible Learning is your, probably that's the one that sold over 1 million copies. And then you've got Visible Learning Feedback, and that is brilliant. But I love this book, Visible Learning Into Action, the International Case Studies of Impact. I mean, this is so interesting with schools all around the world that are, would you say, is this the part of the Visible Learning Plus model where schools have adopted that? So, and what have you learned from these case studies? Because they're everywhere, UK, Hong Kong, Australia, New Zealand. It's such a good book. It's really, really, I'll tweet all of these links out, by the way, to all of these books. But yeah, so John, what did you find interesting about, you know, these international case studies and seeing how your work has been put into action in schools? That must be amazing.
Look, I'm that nerdy, backroom, introvert who loves to do research. And when Visible Learning was published, like, it wasn't part of my career trajectory. Because, you know, as I said, I'm an econometrician measurement. And we just finished a project developing the assessment scheme used in primary and high schools throughout New Zealand. And my team were a bit upset because the project was coming to an end and we're handing it back to the government. And they said, could we have a go at implementing the Visible Learning work, which I'd never contemplated doing? And I said, yes, on the condition that I'm not involved. I don't want to be one of those academics who keep saying the same thing for 10 years and defend the patch. And so they started it, and it grew and grew and grew. And now we're about 10,000 schools a year. And one of the questions that we were asked probably more than anything, particularly in the early days, is, when it's an action, what does it look like? And that was the impetus for that book. And I hope one of the major messages from that book is there is no one right way in terms of implementing visible learning in your school. There are multiple ways of doing it. And I got bad news for you, Kate. I'm about to say I have written 40 books with visible learning in the title. Social studies, early childhood. We wrote one last year, which is really interesting. It probably didn't sell in England. And it certainly didn't even get an appearance in Australia. In America, when they went through COVID, it was much more political than it was anywhere else. And so it also happened at the time where they were going into their major summer holidays. And so there's a lot of fear and angst. So we wrote this book very quickly, thanks to the publishers, on visible learning, distance learning. And it sold, in 8 weeks, it sold over 500,000 copies and beat out Harry and Megan and a few other things. Because there was an emptiness and there was a fear. So the bad news is that you've got about another 40 to read to catch up, and I've got more coming out.
That's what I was going to ask. And actually, they do sell your books in Abu Dhabi, which is amazing because I really struggle getting books out here. But there's, so we've got a few listeners here in the United Arab Emirates. Yep, it's easy to access. Although they don't have all 40 of your books, John, so I'll have to go.
We've got one coming out in childhood, and then very soon talking about Shirley Clark, another one with Shirley Clark. The teacher collective advocacy was so powerful. I said to the team about 4 years ago, what would it look like if we talked about student collective advocacy? But the one I'm most keen to, it's not quite finished yet. In fact, it's one that I'm doing with my son, who's about to turn up to our house with my grandchildren soon. And it's on visible learning for parents.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. So, yeah.
You can see what keeps me going.
Yeah, so actually, you're not really retiring. You're staying very, very busy. We've got some more comments coming in. Faye in Rome, she's a teacher, and she says she absolutely loves your work, and she says she has so many Hattie books. So I've now put the question out there. Kat Chowdhury in Abu Dhabi, I love your books, John. So I'm asking people, does anyone own all 40? We'll give you a mug if you do. We'll give you a teacher talk radio. But we have got prizes, John. Actually, do you know, this is a bit of a random question. I'm sorry, John, but this is, we have lots of our listeners from Twitter, and we just wanted to know if this is you. So there is a Twitter account at @John_Hattie, and it says the official Twitter profile of Professor John Hattie, over 25,000 followers, but doesn't follow anyone, has never tweeted. Is this you?
Yes.
Oh, it is. Okay. We just didn't know if someone had to just set up an account and pretended to be you and just got 25,000 followers. So you are on Twitter, but you...
Well, I had this pressure to go on Twitter. And, you know, someone who's a little bit OCD, sorry, I thought, if I get on Twitter, I'm going to consume me. So I said, no, I'm not prepared to do it. I've got enough to do with emails, enough to do with the rest of things. There's so many others on Twitter. And so they set up the site, and no, I haven't tweeted, and I have no wish or inclination to tweet.
Okay.
And so 25,000 people are just
breaking in purgatory. I'm one of those, John. That's absolutely fine. But I was ready to report, you know, identity theft or someone pretending to be you. But you've cleared that up. So you've got a Twitter account. But I don't blame you, actually. You can get caught up in all of the Twitter action. But there is a lot of love for you on Twitter. And we've got another comment from Mal. Oh, I've just lost John Hattie because he's on the phone. Let me just try and ring him back. And I was just, let's see.
You have reached the message bank of...
Oh, it's gone to his voicemail. Okay, then. Oh, this is what happened live. Not to worry. I think his battery's died. I will play the news and I'll just message John now because he's... I thought it might have been my international minutes, but I've upgraded that. So what I'll do, yeah, as I said, is I will play the news. I will try and get John Hattie back on the phone. If I can't, not a problem. He did have to go in 15 minutes anyway because he's got his grandchildren visiting him and his family. So special family time. So here we go with today's Teacher Talk Radio news.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. Senior broadcast journalist and ITV political editor Robert Peston has found himself struggling to defend a tweet which claimed teachers did not very much teaching during lockdown. The claim was made in a series of tweets looking at official data on the economy, released on Wednesday. The tweet sparked outrage in the Twitter community, even prompting a response from the account claiming to be run by Larry the Downing Street Cat, who tweeted, "Robert, it's not too late to delete this and apologise." Peston did offer an explanation, later tweeting, "Sorry. I know all teachers work incredibly hard, whether locked down or not. I was not making a point about the amazing contribution they make, but through no fault of their own, we know their productivity is impaired by lockdown. If that was not so, there would have been no need to cancel exams or commission expensive catch-up programmes. In other words, the price of standardised educational outputs has risen significantly, we hope only temporarily." This response did little to stem replies from offended parties, however, with the original tweet now having 2,500 comments and 1,900 retweets. Boris Johnson has unveiled a new plan to commit £55 million into a programme to drive crucial research into education reforms, turbocharging efforts to get girls into school and learning. Johnson stated, "Supporting girls
Hi, John.
Years of quality education
right.
is one of the smartest investments we can make as the
I'm
world
just playing the news.
COVID-19. Otherwise, there we go. We risk creating a lost pandemic."
Right, I will return to that. Sorry, John, I told you this is live radio. All these things happen. But I am aware you've got to go in 10 minutes because you've got family time today. I was just giving you some feedback, actually, from some of our listeners. Lots of excitement about visible learning for parents. So that is definitely something that I think... It's about, like we said, bringing the research and... Well, you always say about the story, don't you? Don't look at the the data and the numbers, that's your job, but we should look at it, what does that tell us? What story does that tell us? You know, so is that what it will be for the parents about, you know, take not necessarily effect sizes, but actually taking that information and sharing it with parents about how they can help their children, I imagine.
Well, my frustration as a measurement person is that, you know, we get stuck on tests, we get stuck on data, we get stuck on numbers, and they're all supposed to be proxies for interpretation. So why don't we go straight to the interpretation and focus on that? It's a bit like formative and summative assessment. When Michael Scriven invented those words, he never used formative and summative assessment. You know, as he says, any assessment can be interpreted formatively and summatively. And so when you say teachers, we're going to talk about formative and summative assessment, their brains immediately go to testing. It's not. And so we use the definitions of formative and summative evaluation. And I think that's been a major problem in our business, is that we've been so over-obsessed with tests and data, we've forgotten the point of it.
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And there's that misunderstanding that I have to often encounter with retrieval practice, with people thinking it to be, you know, drill and kill and testing. What is that?
I've lost you. Oh, there you go.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying about the same misconception can happen with retrieval practice and how people think that that is rigorous drill and kill testing, when actually it's a learning strategy, of course. So,
correct.
Yeah. This happens a lot. Now, I've got five of your books, John. Discovered I need to buy more. Have you written a Visible Learning for Students book? I'm not sure if you said you have or not. Or if you haven't, will you?
Well, ironically, no, but we're in the process. Julie Smith and Ray Smith and, in fact, Janice and myself have planned it out, and we're underway on the writing of it. Yes, so we have one coming up, Mindsets for Students.
Oh, brilliant. And will that link with work from Carol? Only just because you mentioned about mindsets and you're a fan of Carol Dweck. So linking with that.
Yes, it does. We're using a slightly broader notion than growth mindset, because that's just a very specific one. But in terms of, you know, a formative challenge, like I see a lot of the growth mindset as developing confidence to take on challenges. And I think that's the underlying theme of what we're doing, and so that's what we'll be looking at in that one. And a lot of kids aren't allowed to take challenges. They're not given the confidence to take on challenges, and learning's challenging.
Yeah, absolutely, and it can make us uncomfortable at times, and that's it. It's part
sometimes
of
sometimes we can avoid it because we don't want the challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, lots and lots of feedback. All of this is just very positive. People are asking for a release date, but you said you haven't voted yet, have you? So I don't know if you haven't. So sorry about that. But I will tweet out all of this information of your books that are available. I will share them on my account, on the Teacher Talk Radio account, on your behalf, John, on Twitter, because we know you don't like Twitter. So that's absolutely fine. But finally then, and this was... a question again, quite a few teachers said this, and again I appreciate how hard it is, because teaching is, well, actually, is it complex or do we overcomplicate it? But basically this question was, what advice would you have for teachers who are trying to get better?
The whole theme of my work is about the expertise of teachers and school leaders, and quite frankly we're not very good at esteeming that expertise, identifying it, and sadly, so often educators themselves deny that expertise. We generally say the kids did the work, the parents helped. And so my best form of advice is that I want you to think about something that happened in your classroom recently where it was quite impressive, and the kids did something really quite marvellous, they learned something that was hard and difficult. And I just want you to stop and say, what did I do that led to that? And I want the answer to be only one thing. It was because of something you did. Because that's the reality, is that teachers open the doors to these kids learning. And so it is about our expertise, but sometimes we're not very good. No surprise, we reflect on what didn't work well. We're good at that, and then we're very good critics. But I want you to reflect on what went well, and I want you to take the attribution simply back to the expertise of you and do more of that.
Oh, there's lots of love heart emojis coming in for that, John. Oh, it's really, and that links in with all of your work about know thy impact, collaboration, reflection. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent. I've just remembered something that I remembered you speaking in an interview about when there was the list published and there was things lower down the list that you were saying, like teacher subject knowledge, for example, but you were saying actually this is important, but it had a lower effect size. So again, is that so that's a complicated one, because we do recognize the importance of teacher subject knowledge, but what perhaps if someone was to say, oh, but it's low down, so I'm not going to worry about my subject knowledge, what would you sort of say to that if someone said, oh, I'm not going to prioritize subject knowledge because it's got a low effect size?
And I certainly have, and you know, I spent the last 10 years trying to understand why it's low. Like, I accept that it's low. I'm not happy that it's low, but if you then say, of course it matters, you're missing the point. The evidence is very clear it is low. And that we're very close to solving the riddle of why it's so low, and it's like all things, it's obvious once you pick it out. It's the interaction between how you teach and what you know about when you teach it. Like, the best example is, I imagine it happened in Abu Dhabi, it's probably happened in England, where you say, we need to take maths and science teachers or teachers and give them more maths and science content knowledge. Well, we know that doesn't make a damn difference if they teach in a way that is still content-based, lots of knowledge. If you teach in a way that allows kids to make errors, to have student questions rather than teacher questions, oh my gosh, you need subject matter knowledge. If you're standing there talking for 89% of the time, asking 200 questions that require less than 3 words response from the kids, you just need to be one page ahead of the kids. So I think we do understand why it's so low, because too often, from the kids' point of view, it's just about knowing lots. As I said before, the conspiracy is kids above average want you just to keep doing more of that. And so subject matter knowledge hasn't helped because of a particular way of teaching. Put the two together, absolutely subject matter knowledge matters.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. That's really helpful. And we've been tweeting out quotes from your books. And actually, and this is a quote from a TED Talk that links in with what we said about failure, what you just touched upon there, and the mindset. It's in your TED Talk. You said basically, what's the point in coming to school if you know it already? And I just loved that, because I thought, I'm going to pinch that and I'm going to say it to my students when they feel that frustration, when they make the mistakes. And I just love that. There's lots of things that I've taken away from your books and from talking to you and your presentations. There's so much great work. And as well as saying a big thank you for today, just a big thank you in general for everything you've contributed to the teaching profession and all your 40 books, even though I haven't read them all. But all your...
I'm optimistic, and I hope I am optimistic, but in the days when I was allowed to travel overseas, what keeps me going is almost every school I've ever been in, there are excellence. Excellence is all around us. I think as a profession, we need to acknowledge that. Like, it's not all perfect. That excellence is all out there. And when you go into classes and you see that excellence, you see kids turned on to learning, you see that curiosity, that excitement. Wow, is that what keeps me going? That's what it's all about.
Yeah, well, I'd love to meet you one day. Ross Morrison McGill Teacher Toolkit posted a selfie with you that he took pre-COVID, and I was very jealous. But and I remember when I was a newly qualified teacher, it was a huge deal because you were speaking at an event in Wales with the Donaldson Report, and my head teacher at the time met you and was all very excited. So I know that you have been traveling the world for years, and COVID's obviously put a stop to that, but nevertheless you're still going, still got more books and still lots to contribute. So I'm very aware of the time, and I know that you've got your dogs and your grandchildren and your son on the way, so I just want to say thank you so much, John. I've been in touch with you before about my retrieval practice book, and you know, you answered my questions, very knowledgeable. Today myself and lots of the teachers are really, really grateful for your time, and it's good for us to have these conversations, to hear it from, I don't want to say the horse's mouth, but to hear it from you, and to address misconceptions and hear your enthusiasm, hear your great advice. So from me and the Teacher Talk Radio, thank you so much, John.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Right then. So, John, I will leave it now, but I will be in touch because I have a little thank you gift. And I will go back to the news because I am very sorry I interrupted that before.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. Senior broadcast journalist and ITV political editor Robert Peston has found himself struggling to defend a tweet which claimed teachers did not very much teaching during lockdown. The claim was made in a series of tweets looking at official data on the economy, released on Wednesday. The tweet sparked outrage in the Twitter community, even prompting a response from the account claiming to be run by Larry the Downing Street Cat, who tweeted, "Robert, it's not too late to delete this and apologise." Peston did offer an explanation, later tweeting, "Sorry. I know all teachers work incredibly hard, whether locked down or not. I was not making a point about the amazing contribution they make. But through no fault of their own, we know their productivity is impaired by lockdown. If that was not so, there would have been no need to cancel exams or commission expensive catch-up programmes. In other words, the price of standardised educational outputs has risen significantly, we hope only temporarily." This response did little to stem replies from offended parties, however, with the original tweet now having 2,500 comments and 1,900 retweets. Boris Johnson has unveiled a new plan to commit £55 million into a programme to drive crucial research into education reforms, turbocharging efforts to get girls into school and learning. Johnson stated, "Supporting girls to get 12 years of quality education is one of the smartest investments we can make as the world recovers from COVID-19. Otherwise, we risk creating a lost pandemic generation. Across the world, there is a vast untapped resource. Girls whose education has been cut short or denied altogether, who could be leading efforts to pull their communities out of poverty." The Foreign Secretary will also launch a Girls' Education Action Plan to set out the steps to help meet the UK's target to get 40 million more girls into school and 20 million more reading by the age of 10 by 2026. That was your daily education news briefing.
Thank you, Megan. Oh, wow. That was just amazing, chatting to John Hattie for 1 hour. I was incredibly nervous beforehand, although I have spoken to him before, and he's very lovely, very down to earth, as you can tell. I covered everything really that I wanted to, but I still could have spoke to him for a lot longer. So if you do have any more questions, then I can pass them on to him, because as you can see, he's very receptive. He's very keen to address any critique or perhaps misconceptions. I mean, I asked the hard-hitting question, "Are you on Twitter?" But come on, I think we all wanted to know that, didn't we? So just now what we'll do is, anyone, if they want to call in, you can do, and I would encourage you to call in the grey icon at the top if you're using the Podbean app, and call in and give me your feedback on the discussion with Hattie, or if there's anything actually in general that you would like to talk about. So as I said, I've immersed myself in the work of Hattie. I was familiar with it, but I do think it can be a little bit intimidating. Not John himself, because he's an excellent writer, but hearing these terms like effect sizes, meta-analysis, meta-meta-analysis, meta-synthesis. But actually, when you talk to John, he doesn't want to, as we heard, he didn't want to go into the numbers. He wanted to have these conversations. He wants to tell the story about what works. And what is particularly interesting is feedback. And I've avoided writing about feedback in my previous books. In my next book, that is part of the In Action series, and it's being edited by Tom Sherrington and Dylan Williams. Wow, no pressure, but they are both incredible. And there is a chapter in there about feedback. So as I was writing a book about formative assessment in action, I had 5 strands of formative assessment that I had to write about. And it was quite good for me to tackle feedback head on, read lots about feedback,
reflect on my own practice. And as I've said previously in schools, I almost felt shackled by feedback and marking policies from stuff like, again, like I said to John, the right colour pen, you have to write X amount of comments every so often. The students read it and they write a comment and you write a comment back. And we are moving away from this. And I'm very lucky that the school I work at now, we have 4 teaching and learning priorities. And they are literacy, cognitive science, questioning and feedback. And what I really like, I like lots of things about my school, but what I really like is those priorities haven't changed. So what they were the priorities before I arrived, they have continued to be a priority, and it was doing the same but better. How can we improve? And then actually we had a year with online learning, so it was doing the same but differently, so providing feedback in an online environment with hybrid learning. And we're still moving on with that. And in terms of my school, departments actually have autonomy in terms of feedback. So, of course, there has to be this balance between consistency and the differences between different subjects. So basically, we aim to have consistency within the department. So then there is a freedom for me to read as head of department, to read the research, to engage with it, and to find out what is the most effective type of feedback. Because as Hattie just said, he said, well, yes, your feedback has a high effect size, but we could give feedback back badly, and it could have a negative impact on attainment, progress, and achievement. So he said, you know, we need to be wary that we're not just looking at the effect size and thinking, oh, feedback has a positive impact, but we need to then ask more questions around that. So great books in terms of feedback would be John Hattie's, and I will tweet all of these out. I didn't realise he'd written 40 books. I knew he'd written books before Visible Learning, but 40 books, oh my goodness. But these are his main ones. So Visible Learning is the synthesis of over 800 meta-analyses relating to achievement. Don't be put off or intimidated by that synthesis meta-analyses, because actually, as I said, John is a fantastic writer. He knows his audience. He is writing for teachers. He explains it very clearly, very thoroughly. It's a really fascinating read. Then he teamed up with Shirley Clark for Visible Learning Feedback. And actually, this draws on quite a lot of the work as well of Dylan William, as amongst, I think, Ron Berger as well, lots of other people. And we already mentioned about his work with Graham Nuttall. And we've got Tom Rogers calling in live. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, mate?
Not too bad. I'm only dropping in just to say a great interview. And yeah, I picked up quite a lot from that. But I was wondering what your key takeaway from it was in terms of, was it his Twitter account or was it something else?
Well, that is good to know, actually, because I was a little bit worried that somebody was impersonating him. But I can totally see why he doesn't have Twitter, though, because yeah, it would just be constant, wouldn't it? So it's probably best that he does. I would love him to have Twitter, to be honest, because he would share so much great stuff. But
you'd tweet about him as much as the Bjorks, wouldn't you, if he had Twitter?
Yeah, well, the Bjorks aren't on Twitter, you know, and I'm going to try and get a petition to get them to join. So yes, but no, I just, do you know what, I really, a few things I've taken away is just how honest he is about, he says, yeah, thing, yeah. You know, he says, oh, this was bonkers, and you know, and governments did this and this doesn't work, and actually when he said about subject knowledge having a low effect size, and he said he didn't like that, but that's what the data said. So when people are critical of, because we know subject knowledge is important, of course it is, Tom, we're history teachers, but any subject. Subject knowledge helps us with our confidence, helps us with our explanations, but it has a low effect size. But actually that's not a criticism of Hattie though, is it? Because he's just saying, look, I'm just sharing this data from the meta-analysis. I don't like that it's low. I wish it was higher, because I think subject knowledge is important, but that's what his PhD is in measurement and statistics. So he has to look at that data. So I think,
yeah, exactly.
that's really interesting as well. And it was quite good that I was able to talk to him about, he is really good when it comes to critique. He is just very open. He's never defensive. He's always is able to, you know, explain his points really, really well. So he knows he's got a lot of champions. And as I said, in his acknowledgements of his books, he thanks people who have critiqued his work and improved it. Like he said, his wife said, "Who's going to read this book?" and then he improved it. So I really like his openness to critique and feedback.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was good. Very down to earth.
No, it's so down to it. So lovely. What did you take away, Tom? What did you find most interesting?
I like what you said. I like what you said about feedback. Sorry, that's my croaky voice. My voice isn't breaking. I've just got really bad mouth today, so I'm dying. I like what you said about feedback. When he said, what were the three things he said? He said, thinking about it from the student perspective and thinking about them hearing the feedback, understanding it, and then acting on it. I thought that was a really good little nugget from Hattie. So yeah, enjoyed it.
Yeah, and also what you said about grading lesson observations. He had a really interesting take on that. I really liked that. All of his responses, I was nodding along and I thought, this is great. But if you read anything or ever see him present, he is just full of enthusiasm and optimism. And instead of saying, oh, this doesn't work, and being very negative, he's saying, actually, yes, everything works. Well, I say everything. From the effect sizes, pretty much it was 95 to 97% of everything we do in the classroom has a positive impact on learning. So actually, he was saying almost everything we do as teachers. Of course, there can be some things that can have a negative impact on learning, but generally, day to day, what we are doing is helping our students. So then what we need to do is look at all of those things, think what helps students the most, what's having the most impact, what works best. And it's a really sort of simple question. You could answer it simply by just saying these are the top five effect sizes, but there's more to it than that. And Seb Ventura has also said, can we stop doing what wastes time? Which I think we're moving in that direction, aren't we? But there is still a bit of nonsense out there. There is still some things that I think are happening that actually, when you think, as Seb said, about too much marking, and sort of lots of heads of departments saying that they would love to have meetings where they can talk about teaching and learning, but they have to do all the admin. And of course, that is important and it is part of our job as leaders. But there have been times where we've all just thought, really, do I really need to be doing this? Is this a paper trail? Is it a tick box exercise? And that's what Hattie said. He was very worried about effect sizes becoming a tick box and that people would just say, right, these are what. And that's why I really loved, and I would recommend it, the Visible Learning Into Action book. I hadn't even heard of it actually until I saw it in the bookstore. And it's about all of these schools around the world. So Australia, Hong Kong, there's the UK, a primary school in the UK and a secondary school, Sweden, all of these schools that have taken visible learning. And as he said, he wasn't telling them what to do. They were implementing his research into their context. And I think there's a lot of schools that sort of have the tagline, we're a visible learning school, but then it's interesting to see what made some of that visible learning school. What is it that they are doing and are they really listening? And wasn't that interesting what you said about Carol Dweck as well?
I missed that bit. What did he say?
So he's friends with Carol Dweck, and basically he made the point that people who, not all people, but some people who critique his work haven't read his book.
Yeah.
And then I made the point, as so many schools adopted the growth mindset, model mindset by Carol Dweck without reading the book as well. And then it got sort of morphed into posters and, you know, assemblies and things like that. And then everybody said, oh, that's not effective. And then Carol Dweck is saying, but that's not what I said. You know, that's not what she yeah. wrote. And he said both him and Carol had a conversation. They went out for dinner. They had a conversation about how frustrating. I know, yeah. Carol Dweck, her husband, John Hattie. I'd love to be in that restaurant. Imagine. Oh, I'd be like, sorry, can I have a selfie for Twitter?
Oh, for God's sake.
Oh, absolutely. That's my new goal. but to get a selfie with Hattie. But yes, they had this conversation about how frustrated they were that their works have been incredibly popular and well-known. Two of the biggest names in education, Carol Dweck, John Hattie. But their work has been misunderstood by a lot of people. So that is quite a shame. And that's something to actually be very mindful of, I think, moving forward. Because we touched upon Guy Claxton's book as well. And he said what he really liked was he wants to sort of put an end to the trad progressive divide. But again, you know, I haven't read that book, Tom. You have, and your episode. So for anyone who missed that, Tom was chatting to Guy Claxton yesterday, and you can listen to that as a podcast. You know, and I really, as someone who is an advocate for cognitive science and don't always agree with things I've seen from Guy Claxton, I'm not in a position to critique it. I haven't read the book. You know, I haven't. So I've just got this impression from sort of snippets. And talking to John Hattie made me realise, I think we probably do that quite a lot in education, that we make these assumptions, we jump on bandwagons, myself included, without actually having the time to sort of fully understand something that we're embracing. Growth mindset, classic example.
Definitely. Right, listen, Jones, I've got to go because I'm literally walking into school now. So I will.
No worries.
I just thought I'd drop you a line. So, yeah, enjoy and catch you soon.
Yeah, bye, Tom.
Cheers.
If anyone else wants to call in, we are live. If you've got the Podbean app, you can call in, chat to me. What were your takeaways from the show with Hattie? What I've said to Tom was I always love his enthusiasm. I always love how he's so willing to help teachers. He's retiring from teaching at the university where he's taught and supported over 200 PhD students. But he's still carrying on with meta-analysis. He's still got more books to write. And that was exciting, that exclusive, that visible learning for students and visible learning for parents. So no release date yet because he's currently working on the Visible Learning for Parents book and the Visible Learning for Parents and Visible Learning for Students book is in the pipeline. So yes, I'm just trying to read these comments and please do send any tweets to me. I'm at @KateJones_teach. Oh, but now actually might be a really good time to announce who my guest is next week. There's a bit of a theme, probably because of my own sort of bias and how I'm interested in academic research. And my guest next week is Professor Paul Kirschner. Now, if you follow me on Twitter, you will know that I'm a massive fan of Paul Kirschner. And if you're familiar with Research Ed events, he's often speaking at those. He's co-authored the wonderful book, How Learning Happens, with Carl Hendrick. He's authored lots of other books as well. And he's written blogs. He's lots of the research I have engaged with. This links really well. So Guy Claxton was critiquing a research paper that was written by Paul Kirschner, Sweller and Clark. So I can always ask Paul Kirschner about that next week. He will be live to take our questions. Something else he's written about, because someone else who I'm also a fan is Pedro de Bouquier, who has been a guest on a previous show with Noreen. And Pedro and Paul Kirschner write about urban myths, learning and education. He calls them these zombie myths, these myths that still linger. Learning styles is the one that springs to mind. But if your school are promoting what you would consider to be a zombie myth, so what I mean by that is something that has been debunked, then please do let me know and we can talk about that. We can ask about that. because, as I've said, early in my career, I didn't do much reading. I was 21 when I started teaching, and I had lots of A-level classes, and it was very overwhelming. And obviously, when you're 21, you've got a busy social life as well, which I don't have as busy now. So I didn't engage with reading or research for a few years, but my mindset was fixed in the sense that I just did what I was told. If this was the policy that the school had in terms of feedback or in terms of how you deliver a lesson, how you plan it, I just went with that. And then when I did start reading, and I probably would say this stems from being on Twitter. So in my first school, the deputy head teacher said to us, "Why don't you get on Twitter? It's great." Lots of staff rolled their eyes. I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. Then I found out about TeachMeet events. I found out that teachers were blogging. I had no idea that teachers were using social media for professional learning. And I think I probably felt two things. I probably felt quite ashamed because I was seeing all of these teachers doing all this amazing stuff, and I wasn't doing anything for my own professional development. But I also felt hugely inspired as well. And then I did go to a TeachMeet, and then it just sort of went from there, basically. I carried on speaking and reading and writing, and here I am now on a radio show and the author with my fifth book on the way. So I know that's not everybody's journey. So the point that I was making is, over time, I've grown in confidence to challenge policies, shall we say. So in my previous school, there was graded lesson observations, and part of that graded lesson observation criteria was you have to cater for the needs of the different learning styles in your classroom. And I just was not willing to do that. I was not willing to have a visual, a kinesthetic task just so I could get the outstanding. I might have done that early in my career, but I reached a point where I thought, I'm not playing the game. I'm not putting on a show lesson. Instead, I'm going to have a conversation. So what I did was I collected some research and blogs about learning styles and shared them with the senior leadership team. And I also found articles and blogs, and I looked at the work of Professor Rob Coe, and I shared that with the senior leadership team about stop grading lesson observations. And I was worried that perhaps I might come across as being quite difficult, but they did listen to me and we moved in a different direction. And I'm very, very proud of that. So, yes, whether you're listening live or listening later, please do give feedback. So please give feedback to the Teacher Talk Radio account. We are all over social media, by the way. We have a Twitter account, so make sure please follow us on there, because I don't always tweet about Teacher Talk Radio shows from my account because I'm quite busy. So we're on Twitter at TT Radio 2021. The same Facebook. We also have an Instagram page, and I run this Instagram page as well, posting what guests and hosts and what shows are coming up. That's also on Instagram, TT Radio 2021. We also have a LinkedIn page as well. So you can find out all about the shows. We regularly post links in case you missed the show, you want to listen back, but you can subscribe on all podcast providers to Teachers Talk Radio. So lots of people have said, are you on Apple Podcasts? Yes, we are. And then you can just scroll down, because we do appreciate that some of the shows happen whilst you're teaching. And that's the nature of it. It's Teachers Talk Radio. I haven't had yet a classroom teacher as my guest, and that's purely because of the timing. The breakfast slot, 7 a.m. I have asked teachers, and I have got a teacher coming up in a few weeks when it's the half term, but they said, okay, you know, 7 a.m., I'm getting ready, I'm driving to work. It's, you know, it's a great time to listen, but perhaps not the best time to be a guest. But all of our other hosts are very open. We like to hear from a range of voices. We want to hear from people in the classroom. What are your views? What are your experiences? If you're a leader at any level. But also, we value all voices in education, including consultants and academic researchers such as John Hattie, for example. So Follow us on social media. Do get in touch with me. If you've got any questions for Paul Kirshner, please send them to me in advance. I asked all the questions that were sent about Hattie. So I sent questions about, can you explain fec sizes? He answered. I asked him who inspired him. I also asked him a question somebody sent me about learning loss with COVID. He answered that very well with lots of positivity and optimism. Tom Patterson asked about a book that he's read recently, and he talked about the Guy Claxton book and then a few other books about questioning. So I did manage to ask all the questions that were sent to me in advance, because that's it. Teachers Talk Radio is a lot more interactive than your podcast. And I have a podcast, the Love to Teach podcast, where I just record myself and I can record at any time and then it's shared later. It's not live. I mean, you heard today, if you were listening live or if you're listening back, John Hattie got cut off and then I rang him back and it went to his voicemail in Melbourne. But that's it. That's live radio. That's what happens. So, yes, thank you to all the people who sent the questions in. Thank you for taking the time to listen today. Do join me next Friday as I talk to Paul Kirshner. We will be talking about academic research. We'll be talking about his work. We'll be debunking some edu myths. And he's just a fantastic character. We also have a competition. I haven't got the jingle here, but please do go on our Twitter page and you can find out more. If you listen, there's lots of competitions where you can often win a mug, but there's also a competition where you can win £50 and the chance to speak at a high profile educational event. So we're very busy here at Teachers Talk Radio. We are expanding. We're having more shows. We're having more listeners. It's very exciting. So on that note, I will say goodbye. And as I said, do stay in touch and everybody have a lovely weekend.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.